upon news and company. You look them up on the internet. I bought a lot of stuff from them in Tempe, Arizona. It's called Antique Electronic Supply. You don't need to just, you don't have to be getting it for antiques, although I did. But they have a lot of high voltage capacitors, half watt, 1 watt resistors that are hard to get today. A lot of good stuff. They sell Exolite tools, which is very fine tools. And I also recommend again to that station, Kane at W2KJI in New Jersey, KJI Electronics on equipment. Very, very good. What I like about him is he's honest. He'll advise you to get something other than something else, even if it's cheaper and he doesn't make as much money. I think the gentleman had told me about the Cobra compact antenna that he put up for me with Barry. So, need I say more? Back to that, and so he got it.
Now, what I'm curious about, Brian, your FT-270, 5-watt, 2-meter handy-talkie, I'm having trouble believing you're getting to us so well by just the rubber duck. You might be using some form of external antenna. So, how are you doing that? Because whatever you're doing, that's the way we should be using the handy-talkies, Brian. KD2, KIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, KD2KIQ. I had mentioned I wasn't using the rubber duck. I typed onto the handheld, and I had spotty coverage, and I was, you know, if I were able to get
to meter transmit.
It is
2HWW with info where you can get stuff on Long Island.
Most of you are probably familiar with it. They do reviews. There's some there's a lot of profiles and specifications for a lot of old and discontinued radio hardware and antennas and new stuff, and you get a lot of input, a lot of helpful input, technical input on the different configurations and stuff. But what I decided to do, you know, I tried one of those Nagoya, I think it was a quarter wave whip antenna, which was no good. I mean, it worked, but not under the conditions where I'm at, because there's basically that glacial moraine to the south of me that blocks most of everything to the center of Long Island. I tried a Smiley 5/8 slim duck, as they call it, and I had better luck. But now I think the best antenna that I've got so far is it's constructed of ladder line. There's a ferrite bead at the bottom. It's an NFED dipole, dual band. They also sell a VHF version. And from what I gather, the SWR as tested on this particular antenna is something crazy like 1.1 or 1.125, something like that. So I credit that, and apparently this particular design of antenna has a very low takeoff angle, something like 8 degrees, which helps to kind of focus my RF where it needs to go. So I'm pretty lucky as far as that goes. And I got the version that comes with 16 foot of RG58 with a BNC. So I got a bunch of adapters through there, so to kind of future-proof and standardize everything, I think I'm going to go with BNC connectors just for the sake of interoperability. And I also appreciate all the helpful input from everybody as far as the stores and everything goes. I'm certainly going to take that into account. Back to you. K2LIW, KD2KIQ.
Rick, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. Howie, you have the ability to listen before you bring your system up. You are very inconsiderate. You must listen before you bring it up. Find a space. You're stepping on people, and it's just not fair. So, back to you, Dick. K2LIW. Yeah, Howie recognize. We'll get you in a second, Howie. Brian, you got this beautiful ladder line fed antenna. This ladder line fed antenna, the biggest thing I wanted to know, how high up is it? That I didn't hear. Did you mount it on the chimney of the house, on the second floor of the house? Are you on the first floor of the house right now? And don't worry about the insertion loss of adapters, BNC, and Type N, and UHF. Connectors have no loss. You say that on 20 meters, and a whole bunch of people will climb on you and say all kinds of nasty things. Everyone believes connectors have loss. Unless you made it as a carbon granule, it has no loss. The only thing that has loss is something that's got length to it, like a coax cable. And ladder line is very low in loss. So your antenna is what kind of an antenna, and how high up is it? Are you feeding with 30 feet of ladder line? That's what I want to know, Brian, because it's working like a charm. KD2, KIQ, K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. You got it, Brian.
Sorry for butchering your call sign there. It's the way I've got it set up right now is currently I'm sitting outside enjoying the weather. Apparently this type of antenna, it's called a Slim Jim. It's about, I'd say, 5 feet long. The two sides of the ladder line are bent over at the top and soldered together, so it's like almost kind of like a almost like an upside down J pole, I guess. Not really sure, but a guy in Indiana makes them. His call sign is N9TAX. He has a website, N9TAX.com, and he's got a link to his storefront. So if you want to check that out, I guess I'd highly recommend it based on my results. I'm kind of at this point, you know, my resources are kind of limited, so I've got to make do with less. And sounds like this is a home run. I'm piping into the Selden machine, by the way. As far as height above sea level, I live on Conscience Bay, so I'm sitting in the backyard. Where I am is maybe about 10 feet above sea level, and the ladder line I have a fiberglass rod kind of woven through it just to get it sitting vertically. And I guess the top of the antenna is, you know, I guess 15, 16, 17 feet above sea level, so it's pretty... not an ideal setup, but it sounds like it's certainly working, and I'm pretty thrilled about that. K2RIW, KD2KIQ.
Very fine, Brian. Well done. That Slim Jim is working like a charm. And I was fooled when I listened to the 375 output. You sound perfect, but I don't hear you on the input there either. So you're closer to that machine than I am. And when I listen to myself from 2585 into the 375 machine, my audio is a little bit too extreme. So Eric has got the audio from the 375 into the 85 set just right. But from 85 into 375, the audio is a little bit hot, in my opinion. Minor detail. Well done on that antenna. Anybody have any further questions for Brian as to what he's doing? Oh, yes, Howie. You know of other stores, other places where you can buy electronics in Long Island? So V2HWW. Give us that information now, Howie. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Do you hear me okay before I go ahead?
You're fine business. Please proceed.
Comment is this. I don't know if they're still in business. KJI Electronics, not KJ, KRP Electronics, Barry out on Long Island. I don't know if he's doing business. He moved from one place to another place. If you can deal with him, you copy that, Dick, and then I got one more comment.
That's over, and he's on Allen Avenue, Farmingdale.
Okay. Eric, I got to make a comment. This is why Linewalk has issues. If you know the 850, which I think you do, when you bring it up into transmit node, it identifies itself and it says transmit.
net. Do you think I like to step on people? You know, you try to do it in between breaks, and I do listen before I transmit.
Yeah, but you starve everything when you bring up your band packs and makes one band pack and everything else transmitted in 2 meters, Howie.
Problem, it's nothing you can do when there's a break. You know, you step in the middle of the transmission, that's kind of really annoying. I can accept it at the beginning, you know. You hear somebody drop and you bring it up, you know it's going to take a couple extra seconds for your system to come away. That's okay. Just don't do it in the middle of someone's conversation, that's all.
Then I would never get my comment in. Eric, is that right or not? You know, how long did it come up? For 5 seconds? 3 seconds?
Let's put it this way. It's enough that, you know, we know that it takes X number of times. Just not in the middle of somebody trying to explain something, you know. If you cut somebody off at the beginning when they start to pick it up, you know, we can accept that. But, you know, listen before you hit it. That's all I'm saying.
Listening, Eric. The time you key up and then you gotta enter the code. You gotta enter the 5 or 6 digit code. Okay? You know how the 850 works. And we're having a discussion over this, which is how many times they do it. You know if the guy's not doing it to be malicious. That's why Limewalk has a lot of issues, Eric. Okay?
Hey, you guys, calm down. Take it easy. Now, KJI, or KRP, KRP Electronics, we hope he still exists. L&L Electronics, we know he still exists. And I think, Howie, I think you said you know of another electronic place on Long Island. Go right ahead and give us that information, Howie. K2LIW, check that.
Long Island, I think it's Allstate Electronics. I'm not sure it's on Jamaica somewhere. Jamaica or Suffolk. It's in Queens. They sell some old electronic stuff. I've been able to get parts there. I think it's Allstate Electronics or something like that. In Queens. I don't know if anybody knows about that one.
Okay, it's a new one on me. Howie, your audio is a little bit hot, but is that the end of the list of Long Island that you got for us, Howie? WP2HWW, K2LIW, the TechNet?
Roger, when you get out of here, I'm going to drop the link. Speak to you guys later. Have a great evening.
Okay. I thank you guys for all this information. Let's see if Brian has any need for any fills and all the information we've given him. And he can always go to the amateurradio.tv and play it back after a few days. K2KIQ. And if you do find some places that treat you very well, Brian, come back and tell us about it. You've got it, Brian. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Appreciate it very much, guys. One other thing I was thinking of now it escapes me. Figures. Oh, jeez. I'm sorry. I forgot what I was gonna say. I'll give it back up to you.
Brian, it'll occur to you in a few minutes. We're gonna go over to SAW, Bill, and you're allowed to break in and tell us that you thought of what you're going to say. Sounds like Rich has another comment. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, so yes, what have you said? I remember Allstate Electronics, not exactly where in Queens. When I lived in Whitestone, Queens, I went there. The thing was, the father made out a lot of parts. The neighborhood is terrible. You have to buzz you in, yet sizing you up. And when I was walking with a cane, I felt over a target, so be aware.
Okay, thank you for that information, Rich. Bill, Whiskey 2, Sierra Alpha Whiskey. Very nice set of call letters. Over to you, Bill. K2LIW in a second. Sorry to keep you waiting so long.
Hi, good evening, Dick and everyone. This is Bill, W2SAW. I had a simple question about Brown and Woodward curves. As you go away from the resonance frequency of the antenna, we understand that the reactive component increases very quickly, and it seems easy to visualize that. I was wondering what the mechanism behind the increase in the resistance component was in this case. Back to you, RIW, W2SAW.
Hey, you guys have heard me say so often, by the way, those Brown and Woodward curves would tell you what impedance you're going to get from a dipole-like antenna or a monopole antenna of any length, any diameter, any frequency. Very handy set of curves. Real, hard, measured data done by Mr. Brown, Mr. Woodward, who I think worked for Bell Laboratories, but I'm not sure, roughly 1945. That stuff's been around for now, 70 years, been printed in plain sight for the last 50 years or so in the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and I'm always disappointed when I find a very seasoned antenna engineer who's been in the business for 20 years, and they mention the Brown and Woodward curves in Chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and almost always their answer to me is, what chapter is that? What's the name of those curves? What's going on here is that all the courses that we take don't mention these very valuable curves. Everybody thinks you can model an antenna, and it's a modeling equation, which in my opinion is terrible, but people fall in the trap and use it, way out of the range where it's intended to be used. So when you look at those curves, you'll find out that as you increase the length of the antenna, the resistive component increases slowly. When you decrease the length of the antenna, the resistive component decreases slowly. And I'm going to explain that in a minute. You'll soon see why the reactive component is so much more important. Let me drop. When you look at the reactive Brown and Woodward curve, which, by the way, you can see them, you can see those curves on mic number one or mic number two's website. Mic number two, for instance, is K1MJM, but you go to limartechnet.com, and you look for the K2RIW diode impedance matching. There's a little article there in which you will find these particular curves that I'm talking about. And the curves, the reactive curve has various length to diameter ratios, everything from 1,000 to 1 down to 4 to 1. And you would think that's all the ones you're going to use. Not at all. When you take a piece of 14-gauge wire, as we all do, 132 feet long, with an insulator in the middle, we make an 80-meter dipole. 14-gauge wire, 132 feet long. You go through the calculation. The diameter to length ratio is 10,000 to 1. Those curves only go up to 1,000, but you see a definite trend. The curves become more and more steep as you go to a higher and higher length to diameter ratio. Therefore, you get an extremely steep curve for a 10,000 to 1 hour dipole. In other words, with a minor change from the quarter wave resonant point on that curve, because it's half the dipole for the curve. The curves are all for half dipoles, monopoles. A real dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. So, when you go away from a quarter wavelength long, 90 degrees of phase length. Let me drop. If you go a tiny bit longer on your antenna, and it becomes inductive reactive real fast. You go a tiny bit shorter than 90 degrees in length, and it becomes capacitive reactive real fast. Where the hell is that coming from? Okay. You may have heard me say on a number of occasions, how does the dipole really work? If you could see one single cycle of the energy coming out of your transmitter, and you watch it go down that transmission line, let's assume that it's a twin lead 70 ohm transmission line, because the antenna is a 70 ohm impedance at resonance, and you watch the energy of that one cycle, one cycle is made out of red electrons, and all the other cycles are made out of blue electrons, so to speak. So in this Gedanken experiment, in this thought experiment, you're watching that energy turn the corner where the transmission line joins your half-wave dipole, and you watch the energy go down the wire of the dipole. As the energy goes down the wire, roughly 5% of it gets radiated, 95% is left over. When it hits the end of the wire, all of it reflects back.
took a quarter wavelength to go down, a quarter wavelength of time to come back. It comes back exactly 180 degrees out of phase with the new energy coming out of the transmission line right now. Therefore, that signal coming back thinks it sees a short circuit. It's looking at a signal almost equal in amplitude, 180 degrees out of phase. Therefore, the signal gets re-reflected forward in phase with the new energy. Let me drop. The bottom line of all this is that you watch those red electrons on the dipole, that energy of that one cycle bounces back and forth roughly 10 times before the majority of it gets radiated. Radiation is hard. You have to kick that signal in the tail 10 times in a row before it finally leaves the antenna. We all want to believe the energy going down our transmission line hits the dipole and then just jumps into space. Absolutely not. It's got to bounce back and forth 10 times before the majority of it gets radiated. And even that's an exponential decay. You can look at how much energy is left after 20, 30, 40, 100 cycles. It's falling off exponentially. The majority of it's in the first 10 cycles. If you make your antenna a little bit too long, a little bit too short, that signal comes back a little bit too late, a little bit too early. Therefore, you create a phase shift. If you have a lagging phase shift because the antenna is a little bit too long, we call it an inductive reactance. Let me drop. Because if you really hung an inductor at the end of your transmission line and you look at the signal reflected would have a phase delay. Inductance creates delay. Capacitance creates phase advance when it's a shunt across the end of the transmission line with a series resistor, maybe a 70 ohm resistor. So you can't tell the difference between an inductor that's hanging on the end of your transmission line or a dipole that's too long. In both cases, you create a phase delay. That's why we call it inductive. But the slope of the inductive, the slope of the reactance curve is 10 or 50 times higher in slope than the resistive curve. Therefore, 95% of the work you do when you resonate a dipole is to make sure you're getting rid of the reactive component, because that reactive component builds up real fast. You can easily make 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactance. That's going to be a 20 to 1 standing, it's more than a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio on a 50 ohm line. So in order to stop that reactance, which is so darn destructive, so to speak, from feeding the antenna, in order to stop that reactance from happening, you have to have the antenna the right electrical length. We call that resonance. You resonate first, it will radiate. Let me drop. So if the dipole is full length and 5% of the energy is radiated on each half of the cycle going back and forth on that dipole, one full cycle of going out to the end and bouncing back, roughly 10% of the energy is radiated. If the dipole is too short, not only is it going to be very capacitive, but you don't have as much length to radiate that signal. Therefore, less than 5% of it gets radiated on each half pass. Therefore, the signal coming back, seeing the short circuit, is a larger in magnitude because less of it got radiated. It's closer to a short circuit. You sense that as a lower number of ohms. You see how it all ties together. If the antenna is too short, you don't have enough length to radiate Z energy. Not as much gets radiated. The wave comes back a half wavelength later, almost equal in magnitude. It thinks it sees a short circuit. You think you see a very small number of resistive ohms. So I know this is a little bit crazy the first time you hear it, Bill, and you have to hear it a few times. This is my philosophy of how a dipole works. You're not going to read this in books. It's a philosophy that has worked for me for the last 20-some-odd years of being an antenna designer as an occupation. Let me drop the clock. And all this philosophy may have a lot of errors to it. It's good enough. It worked for me in the design of quite a number of antennas and quite a number of filed patents. And almost all of those patents have been issued. So it does work. And so almost every one of our theories of how electrons work and how atoms work and how molecules work and whatever, they are a philosophy. They are a model. And as time goes on, the model gets more and more complicated as we discover more and more of what Mother Nature is really doing at the atomic level. So, it's a philosophy that for me works. I've told it to a lot of people. A lot of other people have started using the philosophy. They're pleased with the results. I've gotten very little flack on that one, if you know what I mean. So it might be close to the truth, though, Bill. W2SAW, allowed to ask more questions on this one. K2RIW in the second half. We're going to make you into a dipole antenna expert, Bill. You got it, Bill. Somebody say quick question before Bill picks up. Who was that person? Was that Eric?
But I'll wait.
Okay, who is the person who said that quick question?
Okay, do it, Jack.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Finish with him and then I'll ask my question.
You're on. Eric's in the wings, and Bill, I imagine you've heard that philosophy before if you've listened to the TechNet. I've transmitted it a number of times. Some people are tired of hearing it. But because none of the antenna engineers in active service today have a philosophy anything like that, all of the courses they've taken taught them Maxwell's equations, and they've spent thousands of hours, so to speak, finding out how to manipulate the mathematics of the matrix algebra of Maxwell's equations. And you start off making sure you match all of the boundary conditions, and then you plug in these equations. You haven't got the vaguest idea what's working. It's a whole bunch of memorization. The way we teach RF in our schools really needs a huge amount of improvement. A guy who wants to be an antenna engineer by that method taught in our schools requires 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship. He's got to work under the wings of a white-haired guy who's been in the antenna business a long while to learn the real ropes of the business. The school did not give him that raw information. It's got to be improved, in my opinion. W2SAW, KQRIW, you got it, Bill.
Thanks, Dick. I've heard your philosophy before, and it's really inspired me, not in the making of dipoles because of my very constricted space here, but in making small loop antennas. Your philosophy has guided me in that sense to some success. And I was just wondering what was the mechanism of the physical component of the resistance as you increase the length. I suppose it's just an increase in length of the wire that gives that small increase in physical component. And it also opens up a question in my mind about what exactly is meant by the term radiation resistance. Back to you, Dick, W2SAW.
There's a whole class of antennas called traveling wave antenna. Rhombic antenna and beverage antenna are two classic examples, where the signal comes out of the transmitter, goes down the transmission line, hits the antenna, the signal flows down the wire of the antenna once. The wire itself is multiple wavelengths long, in the case of a beverage or a rhombic antenna. So the wire doing the radiating is multiple wavelengths long. At the end of that wire, you've got a 600 ohm terminating resistor to make sure you're not getting reflection on the wire, because any reflection on the wire starts giving you a backload of the antenna pattern. It's a beautiful, nice, clean, forward load out of those traveling wave antennas. In that case, the feed impedance of that antenna is something like 600 or 1,000 ohms. And so, in that case, from the transmission line point of view, it looks like the signal coming out of the transmission line hits the antenna and then jumps into space. That's what it looks like, because the signal is down there once. And as you sweep higher and lower in frequency on a beverage or a rhombic antenna, you see very little change in the apparent impedance. Okay, now let's go back to our finite length antennas called dipole, which is called a standing wave antenna. The word standing wave is giving you a strong hint that the signal is going to be bouncing back and forth. That's what a standing wave is. Let me drop. And now you and I, as an antenna designer, have the requirement to make sure that that standing wave, all of those individual bounces, stay co-phase, stay coordinated with each other. It's the equivalent of pushing your child on a swing. And you do all the pushing at the right time. Each time the child is moving forward, that's when you push forward. If you push forward while the child is moving back, you would not be increasing the energy in the swing, you would be decreasing it. So to keep the energy coming out of your transmission line, going into the antenna, aiding. They have to make it co-phase, in-phase, coordinated. So you resonate the antenna, electronically resonant. Even if your abode is too small, you can't put up a full-length dipole, and you're putting up loops. Let me drop. And at your QRZ.com website, I see a nice picture of the loops that you build. You have the ability to put up a dipole if you want to. The dipole only has to be electronically the right length. I can take an 80-meter dipole, it's supposed to be 132 feet long. I can put up 30 feet of wire instead of 132 feet of wire. I can feed that and get full 98% of my energy radiated by that 32 feet of wire. I got two or three different ways I can do that. I can have a very large range antenna tuner right at that antenna, interface of the antenna and the transmission line. I force that antenna that's too small into resonance with the antenna tuner. I can put, instead of the antenna tuner, I can put the right kind of an ill network that impedance matches it. That's 32 feet of wire, I don't know the exact number, but maybe the resistive component is going to be 10 ohms and the reactive component is going to be 2,000 ohms. And you go to the program called Berkeley, Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, and you come up with this beautiful website where it asks you what is the impedance of your antenna by way of your antenna analyzer or by way of the Brown and Woodward curve, knowing the length of your wire. You come up with an impedance, and you plug in those impedances to that formula, and it asks you what's the impedance of the transmitter. You're going to put in 50 ohms, and what's the frequency? You press go, and it gives you 16 solutions of various L's and Z's and pi networks and T networks and pi L's and whatever. Choose the one that you like. What's the values it gives you? Let me drop. So your antenna is way too small in length. You can re-resonate it by putting the right kind of an L network in there. The simplest network that'll do it is one inductor or one capacitor of just the right value at your favorite frequency in 80 meters. Will take your piece of wire that's much too short and force it into resonance. You can do it by cut and dry. Put the right kind of a loading coil at the beginning of the antenna. The wire itself, zigzag it in various ways. Put a top hat capacitor at the end of the wire. All of these are antenna shortening techniques that force it into resonance even though it's too short. I keep saying resonate first and you can radiate. Electronically resonant. It doesn't have to be full length. Full length is the easiest way. When you do it with a much shorter antenna and you force it into resonance by one of the techniques I just mentioned, it's going to be a higher Q antenna. It's going to be more narrow band because there's less wire in space, less of the energy gets radiated. Therefore, the bounces are going to be stronger. There's going to be more of them. And when you build an antenna with a Q of 20, you're going to get 20 bounces instead of 10 bounces with a Q of 10 antenna. I'm rounding out the numbers, but it's close enough. Let me drop. So every antenna, no matter how you build it, no matter how long you make it, no matter how fat it is, no matter what kind of tuning devices you've added to it, it has an impedance that you can measure with an antenna analyzer, with a vector network analyzer, by way of the Brown and Woodward curves. All kinds of ways you can measure or calculate what is the impedance of your particular antenna with your particular layout. Now, what you could do is make believe that antenna is inside of a black box. You don't know what the antenna looks like. But the real antenna is inside of a cardboard black box. In the second black box, with an equal length transmission line going into it, you put the right resistor and the right inductor or capacitor, and it'll give you, at your favorite frequency, the exact same impedance as your real dipole in the black box. You do it correctly. You can't tell, at that one fixed frequency, which black box contains the real antenna, and which black box contains the resistor and the capacitor, or the resistor and the inductor. It's going to be a resistor and the capacitor if the antenna is too short. Let me drop. That second black box, with all the measurements you can make on the outside at that one frequency, all the measurements you can make on the transmission line, one's going to radiate better than the other, but we're not measuring radiation. We're measuring transmission line characteristics. You can't tell the difference. That resistor that's in the black box, that acts exactly like the resistance of the dipole, and it's not a real resistor. You can't measure the resistance of your real dipole with an ohm meter. It's an electronic resistance. But your equivalent antenna in the black box, you could call that the radiation resistance. So you've now made, electronically, you've made an equivalent circuit in the second black box. That resistor we call it radiation resistor. The apparent resistor on a real dipole that you measure with your antenna analyzer or your vector network analyzer, we call it the radiation resistance. Give it a name. Electronically, it acts like it's a resistor there. There really is no resistor. It's just the fact that the signal got radiated and the bouncing signal comes back weaker after each bounce, as if it had been absorbed by a resistor. In reality, that same amount of energy that you think got absorbed, it really got radiated. And we call it radiation resistance. Does that make a little more sense, Bill? W2SAW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Yes, that does help clear things up a bit. And I guess my loop antennas are just impedance matching devices that radiate.
That's one way of looking at it. One of the antennas that I've worked on, it really is a mind blower. When it comes to making extremely broadband antennas that fit the requirement, there's an antenna called the towel bar antenna that in the particular circuit that I was using, in a particular military program, this was a Navy airplane, happened to be the EA-6B Navy airplane. On the left side of the rudder and the right side of the rudder is a so-called towel bar antenna, which spans the frequency range of something like 20 to 200 megahertz. The towel bar antenna literally looks like the towel bar you've got in your bathroom. One end of the towel bar that goes into the wall, which goes into the rudder of the airplane, has a 50 ohm transmission line. The other end of the towel bar that goes into the wall, into the rudder of the airplane, has a 50 ohm resistor. So that towel bar itself is a very small number of wavelengths long. It is a leaky dummy load. The antenna has got very low standing wave ratio, covers a very wide frequency range, 10 to 1 frequency range. It literally is a leaky radiating dummy load. It's called towel bar antenna. It's very broadband, very low on standing wave ratio, works like a charm. There's a catch. At the low end, its gain is minus 25 dB over isotropic. At the high end, its gain is something like minus 10 dB. The particular signal it's looking for are very strong radar signals, and the airplane is flying high in the air where it gets a lot of that signal from that ground-based radar, so even though the antenna's got very low gain, it more than fulfills the requirement. So there's an antenna, which is almost all resistor. It's a leaky resistor, a leaky dummy load. But for that environment, it works like a charm. It does exactly what they need. And if you don't like the signal strength that comes out of that low-gain antenna, you put a preamplifier after it, build up the signal, so to speak. Within reach.
Repeater, timeout.
Within reason, you get away with that. So, who would ever think that a minus 25 dB gain over isotropic is useful? In certain environments, in other words, I could take your dipole or your loop antenna at your favorite frequency, put a 25 dB attenuator at the end of your transmission line that goes into that antenna. I would have the equal gain of the towel bar antenna. And as long as the signal you want to listen to is 25 dB above your noise, 25 dB above your threshold, you'd still hear that signal through the dummy load. So whether you're using a 25 dB lossy dummy load, a 25 dB loss attenuator on the transmission line of a real antenna, or this tiny antenna wavelength-wise, this thing is only a couple of feet long. When you're down to 20 megacycles, the wavelength is what? It's probably around 10 meters. The wavelength is 30 feet long, and you've only got a couple of feet of antenna there. It's an infinitesimal antenna wavelength-wise. That's why it's so low in efficiency. That's why without the 50 ohm dummy load at the end, it would be a terrible antenna to feed. But it does the job. So there's 5,000 kinds of antennas, Bill. Not everyone's going to agree with me on that one. Some people look at the list of antennas and say, hey, there's only 3,725. Doesn't matter. I say there's roughly 5,000. And whether or not this new antenna is really a a change from an old antenna or a brand new antenna, you and I can argue about that. As long as you're not too persnickety, I think there's 5,000 times. It gives you a little bit of an idea of, let me drop this. A little bit of an idea as to why I believe to be a real antenna designer, under normal circumstances, take 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship. Because there's so darn many tricks you have to learn, rules of thumb, that were not taught to you by the school, and the method by which the school gives you wireless engineering of radiating devices like antennas is so far off target to the poor teaching techniques, and the fact that there's such a large number of antennas of various techniques, to really get a handle on all that as to what's going on at the electron level, so to speak, it takes 20 years of apprenticeship to be comfortable with antenna design. That's an opinion. W2SAW, K2RIW. Yes, you're allowed to ask more questions on this one if you want to, Bill. You got it, Bill.
Thank you very much, Dick. Yeah, I think that's pretty good for tonight. I would like to come back at some time to ask more questions on this. K2RIW, W2SAW.
Go right ahead with your question, Eric. Wait for the beeps and fire away. Go easy with me, Eric.
K2RIW, K3J. Okay, this is going to be very hypothetical. And I'm not asking you to give away any of your secrets, not that you actually have any, you've explained many of them. But let's say, hypothetically, Professor Dick is going to write a white paper describing his visualization of his philosophy in a dipole. And what I'm interested in is, how would you write a proof describing the actual process? That's interesting to me.
Yeah, this philosophy that I usually show as a, what do I call that, an animation, where all the electrons coming out of your transmitter are blue, and then for one whole cycle, the energy coming out of your transmitter is made out of red electrons. So whether, and you're operating at 72 watts on a 72 ohm transmission line, which means you're putting 72 volts at 1 ampere at exactly 1 gigahertz, into this twin lead, and so each cycle has got 72 nanojoules, because on 1 gigahertz is 1 nanosecond per cycle, 72 volts and 1 ampere is 72 joules per second, but each cycle is only 1 nanosecond long, so 72 nanojoules of energy. So for one cycle coming out of your transmitter, whether you consider it a cycle of energy, a cycle of voltage, or a cycle of current, that's your choice. But you're watching these red electrons of this one cycle of energy go down the transmission line, and you watch them go into the dipole, they turn the corner, go to the dipole, and they bounce back and forth, roughly 10 times, if it's a full-size dipole. That's a philosophy. Now you're going to say, how in the world are you going to prove that? Okay. By way of my antenna analyzer, right at that antenna, I can measure impedance versus frequency. And so I know that if the antenna is too long compared to a quarter wavelength on each side, half wave total, I know that the energy is going to come back if it's too long, it's going to come back a little bit late. I'm going to see inductance. If the antenna is a little bit too short, it's going to come back too soon. I'm going to see capacitance. But by way of the measurements I can make, I can see a one-to-one relationship between whether or not I see inductance and how much, whether I see capacitance and how much, as a function of length. I also have said that because of the amount of signal being radiated, 5% rough.
Repeater, time out.
Because roughly 5% of the energy is being radiated on each cycle, and because there's roughly 10 cycles of bounce back and forth before the energy gets radiated, I could therefore look at the bandwidth versus frequency. By sweeping in frequency, I can measure the bandwidth of the antenna. 10 cycles of bounce gives me a 10 of Q. I can measure the Q of the antenna. Q, one of the definitions of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. I measure the bandwidth of the antenna, I measure the center frequency, and sure enough, it peaks 10 to 1. So I can confirm that it's got a Q of 10. I can also confirm that it's got a Q of 10 by measuring the rise time. I put a very brief, sharp, rising pulse of RF energy into that antenna. I measure the rise time. I'll come up with a Q of 10. I put a steady state signal into the antenna for a certain length of time. I abruptly stop the signal and I watch it ring down. It's got a Q of 10. So I got three. Q is defined as voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, center frequency divided by bandwidth, rate of shift of phase versus frequency. There's about five or six definitions of Q. I can apply each one of those tests to confirm each one of those definitions of Q. And the dipole will fit the model every one of those times. I've done that. I've watched the antenna rise in current as I put in a brief pulse. I've watched it ring down. I've measured the bandwidth. I've measured the current in the center of the dipole. If it's got a Q of 10, even though my transmission line is giving me 72 volts at 1 ampere, somewhere near the center of that dipole, I will measure 10 amperes of RF current flowing. It's got a Q of 10 because the current rise by 10 to 1. Let me drop it. I measure the voltage at the tips of the antenna. From tip to tip, I'm putting 72 volts on my transmission line into it. Tip to tip, I'll measure 720 volts. The voltage rose by 10. The current rose by 10. The Q was 10. Bandwidth divided by center frequency was 10. Rise time, fall time. I go through all the definitions of Q and bouncing signals, and all of these measurements fit that model. It gives me a lot of confidence that the model is pretty close to the truth. It's not perfect. And I'm rounding out the numbers. Would you really measure a Q of 10? You might measure 8.5 or 12.7. It doesn't matter. I'm talking about the ballpark here. So by all the measurements I can make, I can put it in a screen room and measure how much the signal bounces around in the screen room. I can put it in an anechoic chamber. I can calculate how much signal got radiated. I can calculate how far away the signal is going to be, how many volts per meter. All the testing I do, it fits the model. That tells me the model's pretty good. You're allowed to ask lots more questions about this for where you got your doubts, Eric. KE2EJ, KTRIW in the TechNet.
K2RW, K2EJ. Whether you realize it or not, I mean, thank goodness this is being recorded. Actually, you could clip this out and send it to every university in the world. You've now really done an explanation in a way that I've not heard you do it. And actually, you can now relate the actual process, especially if you visualize. And I like your concept of red and blue electrons. And you could probably go a little deeper into when those red electrons actually get launched, whereas you're saying only 5% of it gets launched on its first pass through that dipole. It's now clear, really, what you're trying to say, and I appreciate your going through the effort of explaining it that way.
Now, you think that I'm going to be holding all this information close to my chest because it's the method by which I earn money, and therefore I don't want to give it away. From my point of view, there's a lot more where that came from, Eric. I don't worry about that in most cases. Unless I happen to be working for a company that had me sign a non-disclosure agreement on some particular project, and then I get to kind of close mouth. Now, I've given you a beautiful model. There's a way I lied to you. I'm going to tell you that the errors in what I just told you. And that is, when I said the amount of energy flowing down that transmission line, I think I told the truth. If you looked at red electrons versus blue electrons, and you really could see the electrons on their slow motion moving, because they're moving at the speed of light, there I am lying to you. Obvious by the fact that when my starter motor on a cold morning has a locked rotor and is drawing 200 amperes, and if my starter motor could take it continuously, and if my battery could take it continuously, and if I had 200 amperes flowing continuously out of that battery into that starter motor, let me drop it. And all the electrons coming out of that battery are blue, but by some magic I make the very next electron coming out of that car battery red. And he asked the question, how long will that red electron take to get to the starter motor from the battery? The answer is roughly 4 hours. In other words, what electrons flowing in a lighter whether it be an antenna or a transmission line, a wire, or really marbles in a pipe. Mother Nature dictates that if you take one marble at the end of the pipe, because current is flowing, she dictates you're going to put another marble to the beginning of the pipe. There's a zillion marbles in that pipe. And in general, any reasonable length of pipe, reasonable diameter, it takes 4 hours for that electron to get down the whole length of that wire.
Picky. You're talking about RF here, you know.
At 1 gigahertz, those electrons are the marbles in the pipe jiggling back and forth. You think that those red electrons are flowing down that transmission line and going down to that wire? Absolutely not. Energy-wise, yes. A wave of energy where one marble in the pipe hits another one and the energy gets moved along. But now, it's at the real current that I'm flowing, 72 volts at 1 ampere on my transmission line, where I'm putting 72 watts into it at 1 gigahertz. If I now calculate how far back and forth those red electrons are jiggling in space, how far are they jiggling? Less than the diameter of a atom. Probably less than the diameter of a proton is their total amount of motion back and forth at a 1 gigahertz rate. So if you wanted to see the red electrons flow down the wire, it wouldn't happen. The wave that you've created flowing down the wire, yes. Those red electrons never get there, Eric. I've oversimplified what's really going on. Get down to the molecular level, it's a lot more complicated. In the case of that wire going from, let me drop it. In the case of that wire going from your car battery to that starter motor, every time you take an electron out of the far end of that wire, Mother Nature says you're going to put an electron into the forward end from the battery. You're going to keep everything balanced. If Mother Nature would let you unbalance it, in theory, you could disconnect the battery, drain all the free electrons out of that piece of wire, and you could drain 200 amperes out of that piece of wire for 4 solid hours. There's that many free electrons in that copper cable going between your battery and your starter motor. She won't let you unbalance that, but if you just took all the free electrons, you could drain 200 amperes. Boy, that's a lot of electrons for 4 hours. You can see why it's only marbles in the pipe. And now if you do the calculation at 10 gigs or 100 gigs, how far are the electrons moving when you're operating at a signal of minus 140 dBm? We're probably talking about a millionth of the diameter of a proton. It's hard to believe that that action is really taking place. KE2EJ, K2RIW, World Ain't Simple.
Wow, K2RIW, K2EJ, I didn't know, you just think so literally. No, it's a good visualization of, well, instead of calling an electron, call it one cycle of a wave. The idea is there. Okay, so that vibration or electromotive force, that force actually begins at some point. And at the point where it begins, till the time that it gets launched out of that wire into free space, is what we're dealing with here. So it really doesn't matter how you visualize it, as long as there's some association with the principle, or at least with the concept of the idea. The fact that, you know, you're going into something that is inductive has its properties of that wave. Not necessarily talking about electrons, but if you want to go that deep, be my guest.
Yeah, I'm giving you the places where the model breaks down a little bit. But if you flip over to the word energy of the cycle, as opposed to real motion of electrons, you're back into reality. Every wave has got a very funny motion. If you have a great big long slinky operating horizontally across your living room, and you wiggle one end of it back and forth, and you watch the wave going down the slinky, you can see the wave, but the individual steel molecules of that slinky are not flowing. They're wiggling back and forth in a particular way. You watch the wave of water crashing against the shore of the of Jones Beach. You think that real wave started miles out, and that wave moved across the water. You think individual water molecules did that. They didn't. The individual water molecules of that energy of that wave are wiggling back and forth in a particular elliptical waveform. They're transmitting energy because they're hitting against each other in a particular way. But the wave that started 1,000 miles away consists of certain water molecules, and none of those water molecules get to you at Jones Beach when it crashes against the shore. The energy of those waves, yes. The individual water molecules, they essentially stay where they are. They just wiggle in a particular way. So almost all wave energy is like that. Even a microwave signal going down a waveguide. Did the electrons really flow down that waveguide? The answer is no. They wiggle back and forth in a particular way in order to transmit that energy. K2EJ for any other comments. K2RIW in the deck, man.
Good. K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, let me just point out that this area of discussion really related to how you describe a principle or a function to another human being. Not necessarily the literal of what the factual reality is, but when you try to describe something, and that can be an art, you know, it doesn't have to be precise, whereas you can get a concept or an idea across to the next person that may not have the grasp to have the depth and understanding, but yet you can still explain a principle in a way that they can understand and follow what it is that you're saying. But again, overall, I love your description. It really works very well. And how it actually fits in the real world as a dipole. And you as an antenna engineer, how it actually gives us a little peek into your mind as to how it functions in this process. It's RWK, you guys.
And if you stare at those Brown and Woodward curves, there's some real magic there that's hidden in plain sight since 1945. You see that when the wire is very skinny, the reactance curve is very steep, and that's bad. It's hard to live with. A very small change in length, a very small change in frequency, and the reactance goes to hell and gone real fast. But if you look at those curves, you realize that if the wire becomes fatter and fatter, the curves become lower and lower in slope, and somewhere around a length to diameter ratio of 4 or 5, the curve becomes flat. You can change the frequency by 50%, and there's no change in reactance. That's been hidden in plain sight for 50 or 60 years, and no one in the antenna design field that I know of has seen that. And a significant percentage of my antenna patents use that phenomenon. When you're operating at 915 megacycles, and the antenna is a piece of copper foil on a piece of mylar, you can make the antenna dipole equivalent, a director equivalent, and reflector equivalent. Let me drop. At 915 megacycles, the dipole is going to be around 4.5 inches long. And if you make the dipole 1 inch wide out of a sheet metal, out of copper tape, very easy to cut it up with your scissors and make it that way. And you end up with this extremely broadband antenna when you do that. You can make a three-element Yagi antenna, which has a Vizsla maximum of 1.05 to 1 across the 3% bandwidth of 902 to 928 megs inclusive. 1.05 to 1. You go to any antenna manufacturer on planet Earth and you ask him to build you a three-element Yagi with that low of Vizsla across that frequency range. Every single one of them will no bid. They did. They say, what the hell are you smoking? Don't you realize that's impossible? The person who says it's impossible should get the hell out of the way of the guy who's doing it. It's been hidden in plain sight on those Brown and Woodward curves. Let me see, 1945 to now, it's roughly 70 years. Ain't that amazing? The way we teach people antenna engineering in our schools, in our books, in our apprenticeship programs and whatever, have kept that information hidden all these years. Now, you amateurs, make sure that you don't spill the beans on this one. Keep this close to your chest. This is vital information. Don't tell anybody. K2EJ, K2RIW in the tech man.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, thank you for that, Jake. It's probably time for you to move on to the mailbag now. So, that was very interesting. K2RIW, K2EJ.
to Worldwide Wide.
Joe recognized. And one of the incidents that occurred to me roughly 5 years ago.